The following podcast is brought to you by The Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
Good morning. It's so wonderful to see you all again. This is the first day of our fall and winter practice period. We've had a couple of weeks interim period after our sesshins and our Jukai ceremonies at Wisdom House. So I hope you enjoyed the two-week holiday. I did, very much, and appreciated last week on Wednesday and Thursday, Muke on Wednesday and Yuka on Thursday hosted a Clean Up the Zendo work practice. And so the Zendo feels very clean, and it's mopped and dusted, and now we no longer have to look at dust on the pipes. It's sparkling ready for our minds for this now fall and winter period of practice. So we begin again. So I want to remind you of the occupation of this land that once belonged to the Lenape group of Native Americans who lived and thrived here for many, many generations. And I think it's good to just in your mind just consider, you know, maybe right where we are, it's a little village, fishing. Apparently from they found lots of shells where they cracked open oysters. So we can think about living on the land in that way. And of course, the Europeans came and had superior firepower and took the land in various guises of buying the land or just taking the land, and slowly moved all the Lenape to the Midwest and some to Canada. There are no Lenape reservations or places here on the East Coast. So I think it's really important to acknowledge that history over and over again. Because right now, you know, for me, it's exciting to uncover what I thought was a settled truth. And something new is revealed. So I grew up thinking that Manhattan was settled by the Dutch. Perhaps later we'll find that there's another group of people that came across the Bering Straits, replacing maybe other kinds of animal life, changing the whole ecology. We'll have a whole other way of looking at the settlement of this area where we live, where we prosper. So I hope that you were able to access and look at the New York Times work in conjunction with the Smithsonian Institution, where they published a radical piece last weekend on 1619, the arrival of the first group of slaves to this country, to this continent. The set of reports, I'm still reading them because this is really quite amazing. The detail, the influence that we can see today on that occurred as a result of that shipload of slaves, of people in bondage that arrived in 1619 as a an influence on the economics, how we organize our economics in this country and how it has grown. The politics, of course, and the history, and where we are today. So if you haven't looked at that, please do. You can get it online and at various museums. They're publishing handouts of incredible articles that have been written. And also on YouTube, you can find the New York Times had a symposium on the Saturday before it was published with some of the main writers and some wonderful poets also on this issue. So, you know, it's like over and over again when we revisit what we think is a settled truth. Huh? Maybe we notice how the very structure of our minds gets fixated. And we shackle our understanding. And it restricts our way of seeing the world. The histories that we were taught when we were in school, when we were kids, that stuff is still there. And unless we vigorously readjust it, we can live in this kind of habitual way of thinking, this habitual mind that does not question. And, of course, then what we think is true, what we see every day, is inaccurate. And I think in my own case, and possibly in yours, realizing that truth is one of the reasons that I was attracted to Zen. The unconventional wisdom of Zen doesn't accept the conventional way of seeing reality. The wisdom of change, of not getting attached to any hypothesis of reality. Of what is. And of course, Zen can only help if we don't repeat that fixity about Zen itself. Of course, that happens. You know, you could say that the entire koan collection in Zen is about trying to disrupt that tendency we have to grasp onto an idea about what is true and then get stuck there. So I want to talk about two koans today which address this issue of how easy it is for our minds to get stuck in limited ways, which prevents us from the joy and the opportunity of being alive to the change that is constantly occurring, the change in our understanding. It's extraordinary. It's marvelous to see it, to experience it, to be alive to the change that's arising. So there are two cases in the Mumon Kan I want to talk about, case 30 and case 33. In case 30, a monk asks Basso, the teacher, what is Buddha? The big question, huh? What is Buddha? And Basso responds, mind is Buddha. So. Then in a later time, another monk asked Basso, the same teacher, the same question. And this time he responds, no mind, no Buddha. What's going on there? That second one we're studying in the Path of Koan class this year, at this month. So in the first case, you've got this sincere Dharma student, maybe one who sits zazen and practices faithfully. He's looking for liberation. What is Buddha? What is waking up? What is enlightenment? So he asks the teacher, what is Buddha? What is this waking up to true reality? To be enlightened, to be a Buddha. What is this? So even asking the question, you can perceive the separation that the asker is asking about Buddha, which is something different from where he is. What is that Buddha over there? What is this waking up to reality? Where is peace of mind? What is it that is not me that I cannot see or be? Tell me, what is Buddha? What is it to wake up? You can almost imagine the Basso's face of kindness, of generosity, when he looks into the face of the questioner and just intimately says, mind is Buddha. Mind is Buddha. If you're searching for mind outside of yourself, you're losing it. It's right in your mind. You already have it. You already have it. Just realize it. It seems really like a gentle response to me. Mind is Buddha. Shh. So the one who asked the question was named Daibai. He later became a great teacher, and it was said that he never abandoned that phrase. He often reaffirmed it, saying, mind is Buddha, when asked questions. But later, in the second case, in the same collection, another Zen follower, this one unnamed, asked the same question. What is Buddha? And this time Basso says, no mind, no Buddha. Again, you know, he's blocking this fixed idea in a different way. This fixed idea of what is Buddha, what is practice, what is zazen, what is enlightenment. No mind, no Buddha. It's a book that a lot of us use by Andy Ferguson called Zen Chinese Heritage. And in that book, there's a story about Basso, this teacher. A monk asked, why do you say that mind is Buddha? Basso said, to stop babies from crying. The monk said, what do you say when they stop crying? No mind, no Buddha. Huh? To stop babies from crying. No mind, no Buddha. The monk then asked, without using either of these teachings, how would you instruct someone? And Basso replied, I would say to him that it's not a thing. It's not a thing. You know, a very straightforward Zen kind of response. There's nothing to hang on to. No grasping of anything. No grasping of what way we think things are, the way things were yesterday. But rather, we're being encouraged to look freshly at each moment. Think about our lives today, our world today. Are we stuck in the 90s? In the 60s? In the 10s? It's not a thing. Another time he was asked, what is the essential meaning of Buddhism? And Basu said, what is the meaning of this moment? This moment. You know, it's refreshing and challenging to realize that in each moment, we need to take another look. The right way, the right view has to be realized freshly. Over and over, we come back to that beginner's mind, to that mind of not knowing, so that we can experience what's arising in the moment. So, how does that apply to the Buddhist teachings, the Zen way? How to determine in your Zen practice what to hold on to and what to let go of? You know, those of us in communities are always faced with that question. So we're always being asked to change something to make it different from what it is. So does that make sense in terms of practice? Is there a big difference between a 45-minute period of Zazen and a 40-minute period of Zazen? What about 30 minutes? There's a great teaching about this in an unusual place for us Zen folks. It's in the early Buddhist sutras, the earliest ones, said to be the original teachings of the Buddha, but history might argue about that. Anyway, in the Majjhima Nikaya, number 22, there's a teaching called the Alagdupama Sutra, Sutta, the water snake simile. And this sutta comprises two similes, and both are kind of like, mind is Buddha, no mind, no Buddha. And not only that, but have to do with our life situation today in this changing world. In the first simile, the Buddha meets with a monk who disagrees with the practice of the monks. In this case, the rule against sensual pleasures. If you recall, the earliest monks had strict rules about enjoying most anything. Just saying. So the Buddha asks the monk, says that the monk is not grasping the Dharma properly. He gives a teaching to the monk who is particularly interested in affection for women. And yet you could say that whatever kind of sensual pleasure was not allowed at that time. So the Buddha tells this monk that he's not grasping the Dharma properly, the Dhamma. He says that many people who study the Dharma don't get it right. They miss the point, and they distort it. He says it's like trying to catch a water snake. If you see a coiled up water snake and try to pick it up by the tail, it will turn and bite you. He says, in the same way, if you practice and study the Dharma in the wrong way, you'll end up suffering. But if you see a forked stick and pin the snake's head down, then it will not harm you because you have grasped it correctly. So in the same way, the right graspedness of the Dharma will protect you. So just for a moment, consider your own practice. Is it too flaccid? Is it too strict? Is it rigid? Are you beating yourself up because you don't practice enough? Or are you zoning out and ignoring the realities of your life? Are you grasping the Dharma correctly? Or are you using the idea of emptiness to avoid your responsibilities? Do you grasp the Dharma correctly? My advice to you is not to try to attain anything. To enjoy your practice. Sit in the fullness of your life. In the moment. Not causing yourself suffering for what you're not getting. So this same sutra, which is interesting anyway, Alagdupama Sutra, goes on with a second simile. One that's well known in popular Buddhism because we like the idea. The simile of the raft. Here the Buddha tells a person who travels on a path, tells about a person who travels on a path and encounters a body of water. And that person makes a raft out of grass, twigs, branches, and leaves, and crosses over the water on the raft. The Buddha asks, when that person gets to the other side and realizes how useful and beneficial the raft has been, should that person hoist the raft on their head and carry it wherever they'd like? Of course not, the sutra says. Understanding, quote, understanding the Dhamma as taught compared to a raft, you should let go even of Dhammas, to say nothing of non-Dhammas. That to me sounds like Basso in case 33. When an unnamed Zen student asks, what is Buddha? And Basso responds, no mind, no Buddha. To me it sounds like, let go of your ideas of Buddha. Let go of your ideas of mind. Drop it all, like a raft that you've used to move through the water of practice, of questioning and study, and now stop it. No mind, no Buddha, no idea. Basso was once asked, what is the essential meaning of Buddhism? And his response was, what is the meaning of the moment? What is the meaning of this moment? Or we could turn to Vimalakirti, the hero of the sutra that we'll be studying until Christmas, till December. He teaches that the practice, unless the practice is functioning in your day-to-day life, it's just entertainment. Unless the practice is functioning in your day-to-day life, it's just entertainment. It's extra. So today, you know, we need to look at all the so-called truths that we cherished last year, 10 years ago, many years ago, whether it's about gender or class, race, all kinds of history. We're talking these days about being awake, being woke, and realizing soon enough that our new truths will need some amending. As inevitable change continues, inevitable change. So these two truths, mind is Buddha. It's in your mind. You're creating something. What if you remove that idea, what's there? Mind is Buddha. And immediately, no mind, no Buddha. Can you practice every day and not turn it into something? Not turn it into a thing, a truth that you're clinging to, a raft that you're carrying down Broadway. But instead, appreciate the flow of life, the flow of change that's all around us and in our minds. Appreciate the constant flow of change. It's a joy if we're not resistant, not fixed, trying to grab that snake by the head. Watch out. Or by the tail. Obviously, I don't have a lot of experience there. So let me end with a gatha. We talk of change as if we are somehow not part of it, but we too flow along, whether we know it or not.